The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. Okay, we've got Kirk O'Fell, who's a good friend, a Navy veteran, and worth distinguishing, part of the Silent Service. If you don't know what that is the Submariner community, which I've always heard it takes a unique type of individual to be in the submarine service. Is that, I've got to assume that's because of the tight, close quarter, you don't see anything that's underwater. I mean, it's complete faith in the crew that you're operating, you know, your tactics and your techniques. If you go into, you know, let's say submarine to submarine warfare, I've heard it takes a unique individual.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I don't know what it is that inspires people to get on a big tube that it's designed purposely and intentionally to sink itself. And traditionally we have submarines. I mean, think about the number of warships. You got I'd say about 320 different warships in the Navy. And I'd say about 75 to 80 of them are probably submarine platforms. There's multiple different types of submarines.
Fast attack.
The boomer subs could beach themselves on any country other than America and Russia. And that country would, by proxy, have the third most powerful weapon arsenal in the world. So people don't realize what we go trucking with on those submarines. But there's guided missile subs, there's ballistic missile subs, there's fast attack subs, and then there's special project boats. You've probably seen some of those. I was able to get on a fast attack submarine, and I was just really lucky to be at school to where I had instructors that were like, you don't want to go there. You know, so you have instructors that would invest into you, and they would kind of coach you and guide you along. I'm like anybody else that joined the military, though. I watched a lot of movies. And I watched a movie with, like, I think it was Denzel Washington. There was Hunt for October. Obviously, I read every Tom Clancy novel I could. But
the GOAT.
Yeah, think of it like this. I've always viewed submariners as the absolute dyslexic version of SEALs, right? We're the opposite of you in every way. But we're trained incredibly hard, which is something that I think we both share. Like, the conditioning and the training that you get into before you get on a boat is a high, right? And we do that because it only takes one dipshit, or sorry, I don't know if you had to edit that out, but it takes one person who lacks the professional etiquette that the rest of us have to make one accidental bump to a muzzle ball valve that could bring an entire ship down, right? So it doesn't take much to compromise the integrity of a submarine, which is why we pressure test the shit out of the crew as it gets there. So when you get to the boat, you're an FNG like everybody else. They typically call you a nub. I'm sure you saw it too, a non-useful body. All you do is take up berthing space and breathe their air and fill their shit tanks and eat their food, right? So you have to contribute to the crew. And I like that. I like how it was strength through attrition. I like that you would see the smallest people in damage control wet training turn into the biggest heroes, right? You can see the toughest guys that would implode under the pressure of the smallest task. And it really lent itself to those that had the ability to find ways to navigate objectively through moments of pressure. It's just, we're not doing it chasing people down. We're doing it trying to contribute to a crew, because you have some people that are working on only one aspect. We go very high, wide, and deep on the submarine community, and we invest a lot into people to go an inch wide and a mile deep into certain elements on the submarine. Not everybody's a generalist, right? I mean, your cooks can draw primary and secondary nuclear propulsion on a fast attack submarine.
No kidding.
Yeah, they have to if they want to earn their warfare pin. And that's why it takes a year. I mean, they're not going to go out there and operate valves, but they'll definitely understand the mechanical and electrical
commutation. If they need to step up, because, yeah.
I liked being on a submarine because it felt like not everybody could be there. And I felt like I was around a different type of crew. I felt like I was around people, because you had to triple volunteer to get on a submarine, right? You volunteered for the Navy, then you had to volunteer for the community itself, and then you had to volunteer to be on a fast attack, right? So you're kind of, it's not for everybody. And most of the people that were there, they all had scars or baggage, or they've been through some pressure testing in life that they all brought that with them. And that just equates to grit. So you would find people with a relentless amount of grit on a chip on their shoulder that you would be immersed with in a crew. And then we were all striving to meet one standard, which means we policed ourselves very well. So if you made it to a sea cruise with us and you came back off that ship and we didn't like you, you were topside with your sea bag getting ready to cross
the
plank.
A standard.
Yeah, and the captain would do that too. I had an amazing commanding officer, and he was – I had two. I mean, that's the other thing is there's always someone that slips through the cracks. I don't care. Even Navy SEALs have people that slip through the cracks.
Oh, without a doubt. Are you kidding me? It's actually a large percentage.
Yeah, yeah.
A large percentage.
Yeah, and I'll say this. That's okay because it polices itself. That will thin the herd eventually.
Or you put those people in a role where they can still contribute, but you – let's say mitigate the damage they can do to the organization or in your terms, the boat.
Well, we had amazing officers. We had well-trained, well-led officers. And the captains, to be a captain of a fast attack, think about this. There's 75 subs. How many people in the Navy, right? So, you know, the top 320 are the warfare, you know, warship commanding officers. Submarines represent maybe 75 to 80 of those. They represent 50 to 60% of the nuclear deterrence in the world, right? And those captains are mavericks. When you run into a submarine commander, they don't give those out to people on accident, right? Those guys are very, very small fraternity, very tight group, and we expect a lot from them. I had a Navy Academy grad and a Citadel grad, and we had a supply officer on our submarine that made the mistake of running out of pork and beef with like 20 days left on a deployment. So we ate chicken, you know, four meals in a row. That supply officer was the first guy on the submarine with his sea bag as we were surface transiting back into port. And he was off the boat as fast as we could because the commanding officer was like, you don't feed my crew nothing but chicken for 20 straight days.
Yeah.
You're dead to me. Right. So, and the reality is we hold a standard, and I knew that I could be in an environment where the standard was high. It wasn't for everybody. And I wanted to be around people that had to strive to make that standard. And you're not going to rely. Talent doesn't get you there. You have to work hard. And you could just do anything and maybe get on a surface ship, but you cannot do just anything and get on a submarine, right? And I just felt like the strength through attrition lent itself to something that made me proud. And I wanted to be around people that wanted to do more than the average, and I wanted to be around people that wanted to do something exceptional. I felt like submarines did it.
You know, I will say, the only place I really saw a standard upheld was in JSOC.
Oh, that's a different story.
Well, no, it's similar to what you're saying. If somebody didn't meet the standard, their bags were literally packed and they were redeployed or literally, as we say, sent back to the other SEAL teams.
To the fleet.
But you did say something where I think, and we're just not talking military here, that one, you said dipshit, one asshole can take down an organization, take down the boat.
The culture's everything.
But that is just not a militaristic sort of axiom. That is any organization. And that, I mean, you can build a beautiful company with 2,000 employees and somebody ties one on the night before, still has alcohol in their system, gets in one of your trucks and hits a car with a woman and two kids in it. Mm. And guess where that ends up? On the front page of your local news, if not, wider distribution. And it's tough to rebuild after that. So standards are not well defined, not well articulated, and not upheld within a lot of the business organizations that I work with.
And for everything that you just said, that's why it's difficult to define what success looks like for some groups, because it's undefined.
And that goes to AIM. Like, again, your goal, that aim has to be laser tight. There has to be no ambiguity whatsoever. People need to know where they're going. if we sit here in Texas and say, well, if I hold my arms out and say, if I land somewhere in California within this range, which we know that range increases, and we consider that success, then that's nebulous. That is so nebulous, and people will move in different directions. You'll have people, as we say in the Navy, rowing different directions, not totally aligned. And that's tough to do. I don't fault business leaders. But have you ever heard the span of control of any one individual? So they say the span of control of any one leader, and it's different or varying per industry, is anywhere from like 7 to 15 people at the most. So you look at a leader, either a military leader or a CEO, their span of control is 15 people. Now, can they inspire beyond that? Yes. But that's where a CEO is then depending on his SVPs, EVPs, who are then depending on the middle level managers, who are then, well, and I'll say it, you know, you came from a military upbringing. Your father was a Mustang in the Air Force, correct?
Yeah.
Vietnam vet.
I was blessed where my father turned 18 underneath of a wing of an F-4 in Southeast Asia, loading bombs in F-4s.
He turned 18, so he enlisted when he was 17.
And he had a pregnant wife. And he had all of his kids. I mean, I'm his youngest, and he has a son in every branch, right? And I was his youngest, and he was a lieutenant colonel by then. And he was like 40 years old when I graduated high school, 42 years old, something like that. It was ridiculous. So imagine being 42, all your kids are graduated high school, and you're a lieutenant colonel.
Young.
And you're former enlisted, right? So I got to learn from a man that learned how to lead as an enlisted person, which represents 85% of the active duty military. And then I got to learn from a guy that became an officer, which represents about 12% of the active duty military. The other 3% are on the warrant officer sides. You know, there's
LDOs. I still don't know what warrants do. Now, I'll say the SEALs, you know, we'd always be like, what is it that you do?
You know what
it's
I
so
found
well it. Defined in other services. Like the Green Berets have warrants. They're usually like AOICs or operations people within the ODAs.
You know what I found? This is what my observation has been with the warrant officers. They're the guys that just wanted to do the cool shit. They didn't want it to be responsible for managing other people. Does that make sense? Like, how do I just, like if they're in aviation, they normally were like, I don't want to be an officer because officers don't get to fly after. So once they're a major, then they come out of the cockpit and they're managing shit. Where if you're a warrant, you get to fly your whole career.
TF-168 is a perfect example. And we know what those warrants do, and they're the best in the world.
You want people, like on a submarine, I wanted someone who sat on the front of the boat and just knew everything there was to know about sonar, especially when you're underneath the Northern Ice Pack. If we're doing certain things, you need strong fire control technicians that only did nothing like that. So if you're doing counter-drug interdictions and you're sitting around doing cool operations, you need people that are just conditioned and trained to do that shit all day long. And you want experts. And I think that our nation needs, I don't want to take a great pilot and force him to be a well-balanced leader and force him how to learn how to lead a group of people when really I just want him on that stick saving lives all day, every day.
That's the problem with the military, and that's why people get out. You take a F-18 pilot out of the cockpit as a young captain and say, hey, you've got to go to the Pentagon.
Where's the fun?
They're just going to be like, this is not what I came in to do, and I get that. And that's, you know, the Marine Corps contacted me. It was called the TMX, Talent Management Task Force, and it was a lieutenant colonel. And I thought he was messing with me. Contacts me. He's like, hey, you know, we want to bring you in to help us because we're hemorrhaging O4s. And he was already on the right path. He said, we have these traditional tracks, which is the saying is either up or out. Mm-hmm. You either move up to the next rank or you're out. And we had talked about pathways where, again, you look at an F-18 pilot as an example. Hey, you can stay in the cockpit because we also spent to that point, like probably $12 million to train you up in fuel, munitions, training. But it will slow your sort of, let's say, promotion status and make them well aware of, hey, they can get back on track. They'll be behind their peers that just want to command. And some people want to command, and that's fine. They do. But it is a major flaw in the military. I think the military over-professionalized in a way. And they lost the eyeball on the fact that it's about warriors.
I think it's changing.
Warriors.
I think I see a huge change taking place within the military right now. I think that you may have said it best to me one time where it's, I think there are some frontline leaders that we don't have to worry about. There are some politicians that rose through other areas of ranks, and you're going to have that. It's part of human nature. I mean, the military isn't an incubator for society's problems, so we're certainly not immune to it, right? So you're going to find weak leaders that have found a way to make it through, and it doesn't take much. It really doesn't take much. Just like on a submarine, like if someone pissed in the crew's water tank, it only takes one drop, right? So it doesn't take much is what I'm saying. One drop of piss in the water tank on a submarine will have a really negative impact.
Whatever it could be. Yeah.
It has a really horrible impact on culture, which has a horrible impact on output, productivity, safety, and everything downstream of that.
Outcomes.
So I think that it doesn't take much. And I think that what you're seeing is it's cyclical. I think that you have a lot of really good moments where we have a lot of stuff that bring us together and make us better. And I think that we have some areas. I think idle hands. I mean, I think proficiency is a lot to do with the amount of joy or fulfillment people find in their jobs. And if they are, you know, you were talking about something like how big of a difference one bad person can make to a team. I refer to it as this. I had a shitty ass leader on my team, and he came from the military as well. And he came from a community in which you would expect greatness. Mm. And every community, it doesn't matter where you're at every altitude and airspeed, no matter how amazing you are, you will always have an element of failure or an element of weakness. Human nature is that we all struggle with our own insecurities. We all suffer from self-doubt. And without great communications, it could lead us to sabotage ourselves in incredible ways. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I was going to say amen to that.
So I've had people on my team that what I've learned is a lot of people will mistake being busy with being productive. And if they're not capable of doing what they're really meant to be doing, then they're going to go get busy doing a bunch of other useless shit. Until you give them guidance and direction on what the expectations really look like, you have to define what success looks like. And some people will realize, like, man, I don't got that. I don't have the ability to do that. And then you start finding a lack of productivity, but an increase in being busy, and then that creates more noise.
A clear understanding of what they're trying to achieve and then putting deadlines on it. I'm forgetting the name of the principle. If I give you 1 week to accomplish something, you'll fill that entire week.
Yeah, if you give them 1 day, you'll be done in a day.
Exactly. And You talk about engagement, employee engagement is what you're talking about. And we've seen soldiers disengaged because of horrible cultures and they're less productive on the battlefield. But that is a major problem for all industries right now.
Leaders.
The last data I saw, and this was from, I think, SHRM, the Society for Human Resources Management, is that a disengaged employee costs $3,000 for every $10,000 you pay them. In the concepts, I mean, COVID was, I think arguably, and you'd agree, COVID, everyone lost their goddamn minds. From a employer labor market standpoint, there was the great resignation, which then people said, oh shit, I'm not making money. So it was the great regret. But all these concepts of quiet quitting, just doing the bare minimum to make it through.
Oh no, we had people doubling up on jobs. They had people that were taking two jobs. They're all working remote. They're spending half time on one, half time on the other, and people never knew it. We caught multiple people doing double dipping.
Let's go on remote. And then I want to get to what you're doing, which is why I had you on the podcast, because I love, and you're an entrepreneur of a massive company now, Overwatch Mission Critical, founder and
CEO. Which we shared the name for a bit. That's how I discovered you guys. You were in Dripping Springs, and I saw Overwatch written on the board.
And you're like, who are these motherfuckers?
How dare they? Yes. How dare they?
Great minds think alike. It's okay. But you know, the remote workplace, and I've written articles on this. I've said I'm not a fan. Clearly, you know, if you try to get Urban Meyer to build a national championship football team for whatever college, no, you can't do that with your offensive line in Texas, your defensive line in Alabama, and your quarterback sitting in Florida. It just doesn't work. And God bless Jeff Jassy of Amazon, who finally just put a stop on it and said, hey,
bring it in.
You're in the office on Monday, I'm sure a lot of people disagree, but if you can't commit to that, then you're no longer part of this organization. And of course the masses rose up in dissent, but ultimately I had to appreciate that because the Nike CEO just said it. He's like, innovation is declining because people are remote. You can't build relationships. You can't build teams in a remote environment. It's too challenging.
I'll say this though. You know, I look at where you talk about COVID, right? And that actually, for me, I don't view it for the optics that the rest of the world does. I view it as the end. It was the bookend for the end of the fourth industrial revolution, and it really became the beginning of the fifth. The fourth was not shit, not trash, but the fifth is really hopeful, right? And there's a lot of really amazing things. So, you know, you have to have, We had to have a Jimmy Carter before we could have a Ronald Reagan. Like, if I ask you who President Buchanan is, do you know who that is?
He's a president. I couldn't give you the time frame.
Yeah, because no one gives a shit about him because he was the president that let us in. I mean, Abe Lincoln, do you know who that is?
Yes.
He was the president right after Buchanan. So he's the guy that got us out of the Civil War.
Yeah.
You get it? But there's always going to be weak leaders. Okay, you're gonna 1/3 of your leaders are great and they're exceptional. 1/3 are good and 1/3 are shit. And you're not. We have to be honest with ourselves. We were talking about, like, I had a leader on my team, comes from the military and he comes from an area of greatness. I didn't realize until he was gone that the way that removing him or having him remove himself. Try to imagine if you're on your back deck at your house and you have a glass of wine in your house. It's you and you're running around, but when it was light out, you saw that there was a rusty nail on that deck. You don't remember exactly where it was, but everybody saw one. They all know it's there. So now you have your whole team on that back deck at night. Are you running around on that deck, or are you taking your time and tiptoeing around it because you want to make sure that no one's going to stub their toe on a rusty nail? Does that make sense? And it just takes one rusty nail to slow down the momentum of all the team because they're afraid of running into this rusty nail and getting poked. And the reality is that risk is real. It could happen, right? But if you remove one rusty nail, how much movement and activity does that create? It's a much more vibrant energy on that team deck, right? And I didn't realize that until I removed someone who I thought would be a massive contributor because you have leaders that offer positive momentum, mm-hmm. some that are more of a neutral, and then you have the negative outliers as well. And until you remove a negative outlier from a team, like we whipsawed, I can't begin to count, but it could be monetized and quantified exactly how much the value of our business shifted when I removed
one toxic leader.
One rusty nail, yeah. Right? And that was the most revealing. I mean, as a leader, you're a leader, we're founders. We own the market on making more mistakes than everybody else that works for our team. Right? Like no one else will make bigger mistakes that go into the pocket of this business worse than me. They could add up all their mistakes and it still won't add to the same mistakes that I'll make. But I have the right to make those mistakes just like any other human being. I should be able to make mistakes. I don't fire my teams for them they fail. I hope that they don't stop supporting me for the days that I do too. I also have the right to make mistakes and fail as I learn and grow. That's why I tolerate them. It has to be mutually beneficial.
Two-way street.
Does that make sense? And I talk about, you know, the removing of that rusty nail because we talked about how it doesn't take a lot to make the positive impact, but it doesn't take a lot to make a negative either. So we just have to kind of not over-rotate it, but we have to pivot hard when we see these things and we have to be honest with ourselves and we have to see. Sometimes we create false idols. We create false metrics. It could be positive or negative. How many people have you seen take, you know, and make a mountain out of a molehill? How many times have you seen people trivialize something that's absolutely dangerous and they're like, it's going to be okay? And that's maybe cavalier ego. Maybe that's an unappreciation for the reality of risks. Maybe it's just a lack of training, right? Either way, that omnipresence that exists, you and I both, the reason why we get along, I think, is the thing that we care about most is leadership. And the thing that we think has the most profound impact on culture is leadership. It's not talent. And it's actually not even experience. I mean, you have a shit ton of experience. If you were to go back to a team right now, would they measure you on that or they want to understand where you're at today? Right?
Standards. Can you still meet the standard and exceed it?
But that's beautiful because that is a place that not every company, not every business unit, not every team has the discipline, the collective discipline to maintain a standard, right? And that all begins at that standard. And to get and define a standard requires strong leadership with courage, meaning you have to be willing to be convicted to do that without the support of others, as long as you know what you're doing is right.
It takes a strong leader to define the standard. It takes an even stronger leader to maintain the standard, to hold people accountable. And that's, we are seeing a countrywide sort of pandemic of lack of accountability in the workplace. And you brought up firing one individual. And I know that was probably a hard decision for you to make, is getting out of the savior complex that we can save people when the reality is some people just don't have what it takes. Even if they're the most talented person in the world, maybe they're relying on that for the rest of their life. Like, hey, my title is retired Navy SEAL. And there's a lot of guys that just are good being in that bucket, but don't want to actually excel, evolve to do more.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've used the name before, Bill Campbell. The trillion-dollar coach, one of the most renowned business leaders in Silicon Valley and was a mentor to Steve Jobs and everyone else. If you're in Silicon Valley, you know that name extremely well. He was an old football coach and still had that mentality when he switched over to the business world. But I had a good friend, Matt Wilsey, and Bill was his, you know, mentor. And Bill gave me some time, and I asked him a question because I was dealing with something in the SEAL teams. I said, how do you know when to fire somebody? He said, Mike, now, rather than 2 years later. He said, you mow the grass and you cut heads off because you don't want to regret it 2 years later after that individual has poisoned the culture.
It's tough, though, because you want to be a good professional, but you also still want to be a good person.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of these relationships that we have are personable, right? And I had a personal relationship with a person where I knew for 2 quarters I should have played Dr. Kevorkian with that person.
And we've all been there.
Right. Yeah. And but I'll tell you, like, I speak of it now, not in shame, but with pride, because it was a very painful lesson learned, and it cost me. But I'll tell you, like, I may have tried to be a good person. I was being a bad businessman along the way, and I learned that there's a middle ground. But those are lessons that you couldn't have told me. There's not a book that Simon Sinek or Angela Duckworth or any of them could have written that would have told me.
You've got to experience it.
Dude, you got to get in the arena and you got to take a beating, right? And I look at this as a setback. Now, what's going to happen is they're going to be standing on the deck plate ground level as they watch the rocket take off that they were once a part of, and they are no longer at that standard. And I think at the end of the day, the reason why I started losing people is strength through attrition. My Peloton was getting faster and stronger, and some people were falling out of the back end of it, and that's going to happen, right? So think about your community. You have, let's just say from a hillbilly math, there's 300,000 people in the Navy. I don't know if that's true or not. It's an arbitrary number. And I'd say 40,000 join, hoping to get in the Naval Special Warfare community. And of that, maybe 400. I have no idea. Let's say it's 1,000 of them make it into BUDS, where they get to go. And of that, let's say 250, 300 graduate a year. I don't even know if these numbers are real, so just bear with me. How many of them go all the way to the tip of that spear, you know, which is JSOC or SEAL Team 6 or all this?
One out of 40.
So you're really not one out of 40. You're one out of 300,000, right? So it's okay to understand that the higher you go towards the tip of the spear, the less attrition you'll have, or the more, depending on how you look at it, where it ain't for everybody. We level up at each altitude and airspeed individually. That's the one thing that's unique about all of us, is we have our own emotional skill set, our own emotional range, based on the circumstances of our lives. If you've noticed, people that have had challenging childhoods tend to have a better level of resiliency on dealing with trials and tribulations of corporate America as they get older, right? And why is that? It's because they were introduced to emotional things earlier on, so they're more proficient, and they've gotten really good at setting maybe more boundaries around themselves to protect themselves from lessons that are learned, right? But as a leader, I just created better boundaries from that existence, and now I'm more objective in the way that I manage. Like, I don't have a tribe. I don't have a family. I don't even look at us as professionals. I look at my entire team as athletes, and I'm like, you guys are professional athletes. You need to eat like athletes. You need to train like athletes. You need to think like athletes and hold yourself accountable to that level, because I'm trying to build a high-performance team. And if you want to see what it takes, it's not hugs. Go watch The Last Dance. Go see what guys like Michael Jordan, who defined generations of basketball, and who knows how many people he's inspired in that sport, right? And or throughout other sports, what he's done is transcended, just like Gretzky, just like Tiger, just like there's luminaries, right, in every sport. You're an athlete. I'm an athlete. This sport requires us to treat ourselves like athletes and to be objective in the way that we do things. When you're going to create a high-performance team, you're going to have tryouts almost every quarter. And you don't want people feeling like they can't survive, but they have to know what the standard is, and then that it's left for them to decide if the juice is worth the squeeze. Do I want to stay here and pay the price to be a part of this, knowing that it's hard, but, you know, it's worth it? Maybe it's a great place to be from. Maybe it's a hard place to be from sometimes. You know, you probably understand that. But sometimes knowing that we hold ourselves accountable to a team standard means that I don't have to make the mistakes of blurring the lines objectively with the human part of what I do with these people now. They know that I'll block and tackle and do everything that I can for them. But at the same time, I'm not going to let others suffer on this team because they've chosen to not want to do what it takes to meet that standard. And if they can't, then we offer them the support and the resources to do that. And if they meet us halfway, then they're going to get there. But if they choose to ever put less effort into their future than we do, the minute that happens, it triggers an exit.
And I like how you said that. If we had somebody that's below the bar, we give them every resource, coaching, mentoring to get them above the bar and to exceed it. But once we realize that, one, it's they just don't want to do it, or maybe they just don't have the capacity and capability, and that's fine. When you let somebody go, it's not an assessment of their character or worth. Maybe sometimes it is an assessment of their character if they lack integrity.
Yeah.
But it's also you're doing them a service by allowing them to go find a culture where their values align. And that's, you know, that's actually Patty McCord, who was the chief talent officer of Netflix, who wrote the, have you ever seen the Netflix culture deck?
Mm-mm.
Oh, for anyone that's listening, you can go Google the Netflix culture deck, and she will redefine or reframe is the better word, how to approach firing. And she said, hey, the goal is to have an all-star in every seat. Is that a reality? No. But if you've got...
It should be the goal.
It should be. It's always the goal. It's like saying perfection is the goal, but we'll accept nothing less than excellence.
Well, people don't realize their businesses are not static. They're dynamic and ballistic, kinetic at best. And what you're going to have is, like, as soon as you iterate and you arrive at a point where you guys have it all figured out, it's time to adapt again.
Evolve, or you're going to die.
Yeah, adaptation is the necessity of growth, and agility and versatility are the two engines behind it. Like, make no mistake, my team is the backbone of my business, but the clients are the life's blood. And if I don't have my team in concert and in sync with my clients, then solvency is an issue, right? And in this industry, we iterate so fast, and we reinvent ourselves so much more aggressively than every other industry on this earth because of every other industry on this earth.
Well, adaptation and evolution is a necessity for survival.
Yeah.
And
I get to be at the tip of that.
Relevancy. And let's transition to that, because I don't know what I don't know. And data center, which Overwatch Mission Critical, just I'll allow you to give a sort of summary of what it is. But since I've met you, you've exposed me to something, a domain that I just didn't have knowledge in. And how you speak about the fifth revolution, industrial revolution, going on, and I was none the wiser. But, I mean, it's interesting what you guys are doing. I mean, everything revolves around data now, and our ability to secure that data or keep the downstream flow of data moving. But I was even shocked by the power dilemma that you guys are facing, and how that quite literally may be the thing that evolves power for other uses.
It's beautiful.
And so let the listeners know what Overwatch Mission Critical is and does.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair question. So I appreciate that. I'm one of the founders of a company called Overwatch Mission Critical, and it's a professional services and staff augmentation company. We focus and specialize most on building data centers, and we also try to, our mission as a business is to help our clients build emerging technology stacks that improve the lives of everyone around the world. We're benefiting from this right now, as are your listeners. Without technology, this wouldn't be available. What people don't realize is what's happening right now is they're catching this through a data center. So everyone knows what the cloud is, such a prevalent term, and the surge of AI is also a term that everyone understands. What people don't realize is the sky for the cloud and the home for AI sits in a building that sits on the ground, and that building's called a data center. And that data center is literally an on-ramp to the entire internet of the world. And we build those pockets in NFL cities. And we use fiber backbones through the United States to connect the latency of One Wilshire in downtown LA to 121 East Van Buren in Phoenix, Arizona. And I could go from 2323 Bryan in Dallas to 350 Cermak in Chicago to 60 Hudson in downtown Manhattan. I can tell you that there are every carrier hotel in the United States that connects the hub and spoke of the United States through fiber comes through data centers. And people don't realize that every day they use a little computer in their hand, and that computer all day when they activate an app, they're touching a data center. And a data center is a massive aggregation of technology. It's the technology engine. So what do people are like, what does a data center look like? Let me tell you. Have you ever driven by a cornfield? Okay, so imagine going to a building that's four times the size of a Home Depot. But instead of rows upon rows of home improvement equipment, it's just rows upon rows of server farms. It's just server storage, networking, and software stacked up like corn rows. And obviously those things generate a lot of heat, and then we have to reject that heat. So we have a lot of power that goes into these buildings. These buildings are designed to not only island themselves off the grid for a week at a time, but I could actually go cogeneration, close transition, and put power back on the grid. I can move the needle to the left. That's how much reliability goes into these data centers. Mission critical, the mission critical industry used to be measured in downtime. If you operate a business that would, if it went down for 1 second, you could quantify that loss by 1 second by $1 million of lost revenue or death. So if you're the FAA and you're monitoring airplanes and the FAA tower goes down, yeah, you got some issues. People could die. That's mission critical. If you are a bank and you're monitoring all the ATM transactions in North America, or if you're eBay, PayPal, it doesn't matter. If you're e-commerce and you could lose your internet or you could lose the compute capacity you have, your digital infrastructure, for 1 second and you can quantify that by $1 million of lost revenue, that's called mission critical. Mission critical was the initial phrase that was used for the vertical of industry. It's only 25 years old, so it's brand new. The industry itself really has evolved quite a bit in 25 years. So let me put it into this context. So people say, what is a data center? The first utility ever discovered was plumbing, right? The second was power. The third was gas. The fourth was connectivity. Those four are your primary utilities. Can you imagine living in a home and not having those four things? Which one would you rather not have? I think a lot of people are like, I'll give up plumbing, I could go outside. But what you don't give up first is connectivity, because that's access to the world, right? Without connectivity, you don't have access to the world. But if you take those four utilities, plumbing, power, gas, and connectivity, add them together, you make one utility. That fifth utility is the data center. That is the sky for the cloud. That is the engine for AI. And without a data center, you cannot have either of those things. Now, what drives the adoption rate of emerging technology? You and me. The consumer that drives eyeball content and video caching. Every time I'm uploading stuff, every time I'm downloading stuff, every time I'm streaming stuff, every time I'm buying stuff, every time I'm sharing stuff, it always, always, always touches a data center. So all I do is go build these things that no one knows about. It's an oligopoly. It's the best kept secret in the world. But let me share you what else used to be the best kept secret in the world. We're the fifth utility, and people don't even know who we are. The second utility was power. Everybody knows what that was. And I could give you a little history in the Industrial Revolutions and what power already has. The first Industrial Revolution started in 1760 before the Revolutionary War. A lot of really cool things came to us in that time. The cotton gin, lots of stuff in the first Industrial Revolution. The most proficient or profound elements that we found was in a steam engine, which gave us the locomotive engine, which gave us the train that transformed the West. Then we had a little bit of a break between the first and second Industrial Revolutions, as you typically do. There's innovation that takes place, but it's not really turned into a revolution until the second. The second Industrial Revolution is where we found power, electricity, both AC and DC, as well as the combustion engine of an automobile. Again, massive changes to society. Don't get me wrong. Every Industrial Revolution giveth with one hand and it taketh with the other. There's unintended consequences to everything. For us in the first, it really was a lot of pollution, a lot of urbanization. You're taking people from rural areas into cities where you have infestation, you have infections, disease. The second Industrial Revolution gave us a lot of medication. It gave us insulin. It gave us lots of things for vaccines. The second Industrial Revolution gave us a lot of power. But every Industrial Revolution gives us power. There was a break between the second and the third, and that was really because World War I broke out. Then we had Prohibition. We had the Great Depression. Then we had World War II, then we had Korea, and then Vietnam. And at the end of that, in 69, we rolled into the third Industrial Revolution. I was born during that generation in 1975, where some of the cool unintended consequences that came in that generation were convenience food, which we now call fast food. And I don't think any of us understood the impact that fast food would have on humanity, society, the community, or our own personal lives at home. But there's reasons why guys like us don't eat fast food 3-4 meals a day. Not to say we didn't at one point. We were kids. We probably did. Back then, we didn't understand how obesity would impact our economy, right? But at the end of the day, we don't know what you don't know, right? But we spend every Industrial Revolution introducing new technologies that are emerging while simultaneously fixing the challenges that it came from the last one. Try to think of Industrial Revolutions as Goldilocks. At first, it's going to be too hot, and then it's going to be too cold before it's ever just right. And it takes time. I mean, you and I were born in an era where 4 out of 5 dentists or doctors would tell you to smoke Camel Lights instead of Marlboro, right? So the way that they market to us, but it gave birth to a whole other vertical of industry, which is multi-billion dollars, which is Spartan races and tough mudders and marathon runners and the diets and the exercises and all the things that go with those types of lifestyles. But it's really, we get better where there's a more level of awareness that technology gives us. But technology could come in many forms. Technology could come in a handgun. Handguns save a lot of lives. They also take them. But it also comes in the form of social media, which has caused a lot of bullying, a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety, a lot of suicide. But it's also inspired a lot of people. Like, I get the best cooking recipes. I get my workout ideas. I could get a text about Mark Anthony on something romantic that I could send. Or I could have something that's stoic. Sometimes I'm seeing shit that you post, right? So what I'm saying is technology has allowed me to meet you and meet a lot of other people. The third industrial revolution really gave us nuclear power, right? We created nuclear energy, we had nuclear weapons, but we had nuclear power, we had compute power, we started rolling a lot of powers on. Now, the third industrial revolution ended in 2000 at the dot-com bust. Now, when we started the fourth, we started more power. We started quantum compute, we started a lot of AI, AR, VR, autonomous driving vehicles, drone technology, power. Right. But I mean, in the third, we mapped our own genetic DNA. By the fourth, we're editing it. Right. So technology gives us shit, but it also gives us unintended consequences and byproducts that we as society need to muck through. The fifth industrial revolution started at the end of 2020. Right. And that's at the end of COVID, basically. And what happened is we started with the fifth, and the fifth we all know is designed for America, for humanity to have a more healthy or harmonious relationship with the machines and the technology in our lives. What does that mean for people like us? It means it's, we'll look at technology one day like we'd look at fast food today, which is great. So the awareness, that I mean, look, I'm using the same technology to bunk corporate media sometimes or mainstream media to get to actual facts, because there's really important truths that exist that some people don't want to share with us, but the access is out there. Technology allows me to get access to it, which allows me to protect myself, mitigate the risks that I have in my own personal life or that of my business. But I get to use technology in a way in which I'm not scared of it, right? I had no, you and I have talked about this off, I'm like, I think I have 350 whole followers now on my Instagram. Now, it's obviously massively different than my LinkedIn, because that's the only platform I gave a shit about, right? Which I'm investing into my professional
career. You and me both. Yes.
But all my private stuff is my private stuff, right? But I realized, like, I'm at a point now in my life where it's going to be a little bit more blended, but it's okay. I don't need to be scared about posting that stuff, because it's always too hot and too cold before it's just right, and I'm settling in. So will you, right? We will all adapt, but what will happen is we'll find healthier relationships with technology in our lives, just like we do with the food in our lives. We're going to get healthier mentally, spiritually, emotionally, physically from technology. The fifth industrial revolution is going to give us. If you look at every industrial revolution, it comes with power. I think the fifth industrial revolution is where data centers become not only, think about this, it took 40 years before 25% of the U.S. population adopted electricity, okay? If it took 38 years before 25% of the population adopted the automobile. So these are massive emerging technologies that take forever to adopt. We're at year 25 on data centers. Think about the first time data centers were created from technology. Data centers started with the genesis of that. And now we're at a point where not only does our industry grow faster than every other industry because of the growth of every other industry, the more adoption rate of emerging technologies that every industry uses, from healthcare to finance to tech, it doesn't matter, logistics, the more technology that we adopt as consumers as well as a business means the pent-up demand for growing technology in data centers is going to skyrocket. What I told you on my podcast was your kids will either be working in the data center industry when they're older, or they'll be working in orbit of the ecosystem of the data center. It's like, they're not in the automotive industry building cars. They're building tires for them. They're building brakes for them. They're building windshields. Do you get what I'm saying?
Let me ask you this. So let's talk about demand. On average, how long does it take to, and I understand that data centers are different sizes. Yeah. On average, how long does it take to build and set up from cradle to the grave, set up and get a data center running?
Yeah, fair question. It depends. There's multiple types. But I would say with an arbitrary broad stroke, mm-hmm. it's 9 months to 12 months, depending on how much horsepower you could throw behind it. But you got to keep in mind that the race right now is for power. Let me tell you what data centers are going to do to change humanity. Do you want to understand what's going to happen right now? This is why I'm excited about being a nerd, all right? Is why would a nerd sit on a podcast with an everyday warrior talking about shit? And I'll tell you why. Because what's going to happen is, I don't think that there's a lot of people that have confidence in mainstream corporate media, but they also don't disregard all of it. There's smoke, there's fire. I hear a lot of things about climate change, and I hear a lot of things about global warming, and I hear a lot of things about a lot of shit that I don't have any control over. But I will tell you that we as consumers are going to demand so much from technology in the next 5 years, it's going to create a tipping point, as Malcolm Gladwell calls it. And that means, put it into perspective, I came from a submarine that had a 20, I'm think that you can look in a book of Jane's, it'll tell you how big the reactor was. Let's say it's between 20 and 30 megawatts. And that, not every reactor is the same. Not every boat's the same. I'm building data centers that used to start at 10, 5, 10, 12. 20 megawatts was a monster. Now you have groups that don't even pick their teeth with 20 megawatts. We're talking about gigawatt scale power capacity data centers that we're building, and we'll build 2, 3, 400 megawatts at a click. So to put it in perspective, every time that you would chat GPT a question.
This one I love. You mentioned this. This blew my mind. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, people don't realize how much demand compute capacity has on the electrical grid. And this is really awesome that we're talking about this, because when you chat GPT a single question, they estimate that it's the equivalency of charging your phone from 0 to 160 times. And when you draw that much heat, you have to reject the heat. And the best way to do that, think about heat rejection from us. When you are hot, if you're standing in front of a fan, you're going to get semi-cooled. If you throw a little bit of water on you and get the fan, you're going to get a lot cooled. But if you just jump in the water, massive immersion cooling, right? So the radiation of technology and the demand for it is growing so high, so fast, that the topology of footprint in which we build data centers at hasn't really changed. It's now that size data center that used to be 300 megawatts is now going to be, you know, 900 megawatts, because the density in the compute stack is so tight that the volume of aggregate data that flows through that is requiring so much power that it's going to have a shift in our economy, right? This is a digital economy that we live in. And right now, the number one commodity in the world used to be energy, used to be oil and gas. And now the most valuable commodity in the world is data. And we need to get access to more data, and we need to be able to originate and generate it. Now we're not just doing it ourselves as human beings. We've generated more information on Earth in the last year. The metric was, in 2023, we generated more information in those 12 months than we had in the history of the world combined. Right now, we're targeting 9 months. And I mean, the technology, the adoption rate of emerging technology only speeds up over time, right? So if it took 40 years for electricity to be adopted by 25% of the mainstream media, just know this, it took 4.5 years for 100 million people to adopt Instagram. It took 9 months for TikTok for 100 million users. It took ChatGPT 5 days. So the more we roll out technology, the faster the adoption rate of these emerging technologies. And that's a good thing, because the longer we, the faster we adopt it and iterate into something else, the faster we can iterate away from the bad habits and the unintended consequences that came with it, right? So we're moving at another altitude and airspeed on power. And we're building data centers now at such a massive volume of scale that there's just simply not enough power on the grid. And we're staring down the barrel of no less than 20 gigs of demand right now in the next 3 years, because we're in what's called the data center gold rush, which means that we cannot build power plants fast enough, and there's not enough grid capacity in the United States. What you have is you have radically sophisticated procurement teams that are armed to the teeth at Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, as well as the G1K or the Global Fortune 1000. And they are all hiring resources to go pick pockets of power throughout the United States where there were once distressed assets, maybe a smelting plant here that went down, or maybe a power plant there that went down, or maybe you're up in the middle of Pig's Knuckle wherever, and there's a former manufacturing plant that's distressed and it had a negative impact.
But that's still just a Band-Aid on a problem. So we all know that necessity is the mother of all inventions.
Yeah.
So within the data center industry, people are looking at the power dilemma.
So the solution in the next 5 to 10 years is 100% natural gas. There's renewables. The problem with...
Why not nuclear?
Well, nuclear will be the only solution. I'm so glad that we're having this conversation. Let me tell you what we're doing. We're going to get the nuclear.
But there's some... I mean, just the bad perceptions, narrative about nuclear.
People need to go online, and you don't have to be an Oliver Stone fan.
No.
And I'm certainly not, but I mean, objectively, go watch Nuclear Now on Apple TV, and it really breaks out the dichotomy between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. Even Greenpeace is the first ones out there saying, we messed up. We should have not tried to shut down all nukes. We should have shut down nuclear weapons, which I'm 100,000% for. But nuclear energy is the only thing that will save this climate. It's the only, what we are doing with fossil fuels is untenable and unscalable. Mm-hmm. And now we have, we can't use renewables as efficiently as you want. It's a great application. It's an amazing concept, but there's no storage behind solar. I could have a very sunny day and I don't need anything from fossil fuels that day or a windy day. But what happens on the day where I have way more capacity? I don't get to store that. All right. Or I can't put it in an environment which it could be stored in a safe way. Communities don't want that right around their neighborhood. Right. And we don't want that around our neighborhood. So we use the renewables on the days that we can. And on the days that we can't, we use what we have. And that's typically coal or fossil fuels or something else. We're going to go to natural gas because there it's less dangerous. There is storage and capacity, the only limitation right now on natural gas. But there will be the pent up demand will force it to iterate. All right. So pressure and pain is the only thing that makes these changes. And then what you really need is people with big fat brains that are to come in and make a business case to justify the finance move on making the shift. But what we do is we're just patching natural gas, renewable energy solutions together to go. We know that the grid's not going to supply the power that we need for data centers to support the demand of us consumers and these businesses that rely on technology to grow. So what's going to have to happen is we're going to have to start building nuclear power plants, and those don't happen overnight. So we have 10 years to build nuclear power. And once, there's a reason why nuclear submarines aren't laying on the bottom of the ocean. You don't hear stories about nuclear submarines going down ever. Nuclear is way safe. It's just people don't understand that. Like people ask me, would you?
Chernobyl, Three Mile Island.
Yeah, but those aren't
still stuck in their heads.
We're talking about small modular reactors, SMRs. Yes. We're not putting Homer Simpson type shit out in the neighborhood, right? We're going to go have something that is so small. It'll sit somewhere in the neighborhood and no one will even know. You could build a shack around it that looks like a house where it could be safe, where people can't drive a train, people can't harm it, but it'll sit underground, it'll do something. But that 30 megawatt reactor, that'll supply all of that town. And it has to be put way over here and transmission, distribution of energy will be figured out. But at the end of the day, that's going to stop climate change. That's going to stop all the carbon footprint. That's going to really reduce all those things. And that's where you start seeing a big rotation on everybody coming back together, because now we've found a long-term solution for power. It changes the economy. We're less relying on all the plastic and all the things that come from oil and all the carbon emissions that come from all the coal that we burn. And we're going to start reusing renewable energies to help reduce the carbon footprint until we can get to, it's a crawl, walk, run to nuclear. Nuclear is the only way to save the planet. Nuclear is the only solution. And the beauty is this. Let me tell you how the dominoes, we consumers are driving the compute demand of aggregate data, meaning him, you, me, whoever else is uploading and downloading or completing or creating data.
Which I've got to assume was amplified by COVID.
1,000%. You had Microsoft within like the first 2 weeks of COVID said they had a 750 or 775% demand spike in cloud. And that didn't really regress, right? So we as an industry, I was growing at a double-digit CAGR during COVID, even when it was like my guys would be getting on planes and there would only be one person on the airplane sometimes. But like we were essential to making sure that all the compute technology that was being massively utilized during remote operations like COVID didn't go down, right? So like we are the engine under the hood. So people are like, what are data centers? It's the sky for the cloud. The cloud sits on a building on the ground with a bunch of security around it. It's just as hard to get no data center as it is to get on a submarine, right? But not quite, but you know what I'm saying? It's as a civilian, it's tough, right? You're going through all kinds of badge biometrics and there's man traps. There's a million things you go through. You just don't have a person standing there with a gun saying, let me see that ID. That's really the only thing. But there are some operators that have that too.
So I've given multiple speeches. Yeah. It seems like all the data centers in New Mexico. And it was tedious just to get on. I'm like, hey, I'm your guest. But the security protocols were, I understand. I understand. At the time, I probably just didn't want to deal with it.
But people don't realize that the internet is a bunch of buildings on the ground. The sky is on the ground. The sky for the clouds on the ground. And look, we started the worldwide internet or the IoT, the Internet of Things. And we all saw what that did to society and humanity. Then the cloud came in and the cloud had a 10x growth demand over IoT. And we were standing here going, we don't have enough compute capacity to support the adoption rate of emerging technology and the demand of us in society. So what happened next is we started doing a whole bunch more stuff. And as soon as we started getting good at building cloud, all of a sudden this new thing came along called AI. And holy shit, AI took cloud and ripped its head off and said, let me do this right down your neck because this is going to be 100x of what cloud was. And now we all looked at it and we're like, game over. We don't have the ability to keep up with the adoption rate of cloud today, let alone AI. So people are worried about AI's capabilities and limitations. I'm like, let me tell you, AI chews through so much power that we won't be able to use it. And then consumers will be pissed because they can't use it to the full range and effectiveness that AI can actually deliver at, because there's not enough power to support it. And we're going to have to start making changes in the way we address the optics in which we view power will shift like a paradigm mission for everybody. Critical. Well, look, you and I come from mission critical. We didn't measure it in downtime. We measured it in our own mortality, yes. Which is why I focus so hard on bringing military into this industry, because we already get it.
And so I want to get into that, because this is one of probably the top three reasons I asked you to come on. So you are in an industry which of, and you know what? The more I talk to people in data industry, they always just say, oh, we're just a bunch of nerds. You guys are fucking pioneers, man. And switching that mindset. And I know, like, we're all self-deprecating. It's like an infantry guy. You know, I meet an infantry guy and say, I was just infantry. I'm like, no, you're infantry. And you guys win wars.
It's my job to say they were just infantry, not theirs. Does it make sense? Like, yeah. I'm supposed to be, I got infantry guys. I'm like, they're just infantry. But the reality is, you're right. They were special.
So you have made it a point that you're doing well in life. You've got a company that is growing massively, like you said, 20 kicker. But you're trying to bring a lot of veterans along. If I remember correctly from our offline conversations, there is a labor shortage of around 300,000 people in this industry. And yeah. So you're aiming to continue doing what you're doing, support the fifth industrial revolution, but pull as many veterans with discipline and accountability, with commitment, with loyalty into this this industry. And for that, I applaud you. But dude, talk a little about what you're doing to bring more veterans into this space, which also means lucrative careers that they can feed their families and change their station in life.
Yeah, that's what it's all about for me. Like, I love building data centers. I came out of the military in 2000, put myself back through college. I was enlisted, put myself through school as a UPS service engineer, graduated, and had an insatiable appetite to learn. It was accelerated with the fact that I got cancer and was told I wouldn't be alive in a couple years from now. That was 16 years ago, and that changed the way I view every aspect of my life, right? And I was blessed to have that situation so early on in my career, so I didn't waste so much of my time in some homogenous competition or construct that society says I needed to do to be successful. I was able to rip that shit off and go. And what I found was my ability to move throughout the industry. No one cared where I went to college. No one cared if I went to college. There was a set of values that were assigned to the skills or the crafts that I learned while being in the military using my hands. And I did have exposure to leaders, but it was all secondary. It's like secondhand smoking, where I was around leaders. I wasn't senior enough in rank for them to invest time into making me a leader. Maybe it's not their fault. I didn't take that shit very serious when I was in anyway. I was there for a very specific reason, and I knew I was getting out, right? But I loved it. I did not get out because I didn't like it. I actually had a lot of regret when I got out. But I also went in with a very unique purpose, right? And when I came out, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it yet. And I found this industry that was just emerging. So this industry is 25 years old. I got out of the Navy in 2000. That's 24 years ago. So I was here during the very early stages. And I got to watch this industry iterate and evolve. And what I saw was a common theme. I saw people that had an emotional range and the ability to endure pressure in high situation environments, they tend to do better. You know, the pressure either makes the diamond or it makes the splat mark, right? And I found that there was a lot of us that were able to have agility and versatility in the way that we were conditioned and trained, that I was able to outmaneuver some of my civilian counterparts in this space, because they just they weren't used to the trials and tribulations. Where I came from a fast attack submarine where I deployed 288 days a year on average, and I was used to a high tempo, right? And I, not for nothing, but I loved it. I didn't join the Navy to not go to sea. I did it to go to sea, right? And I learned that there's amazing things that you can do if you have the right leaders and the right team. So I started building this team, and I realized that my mission was, and what I got really good at, was building data centers. And I just loved it. And the means and methods and how we do it iterated every week. So experience didn't matter for shit, because the way that we build data centers today is the opposite in which we were doing 2 years ago. And I can't imagine what we're going to be doing in 2 years from now. So it doesn't really matter. I don't ever hire on experience or talent. I only do it on personality and character, because it tends to be the only reason why I fire people anyway.
Humble, hungry, smart.
Pat Lencioni said it best. Why would I try to reinvent that wheel, right? So for me, I just have some really amazing people, and I don't know how much time we have. We have 5 minutes? Well, I want to tell you a story why I built it. Go. I had I have amazing people that work for me, up, over, and out, period, full stop. We have great people. And I have people on my team that have once put weapons in their hands with the intent to harm themselves. And there's a lot more to those stories. And I realized one day when I was taking my career, there's no one in this industry that has partied harder than me. This is the Wild Wild West. People, this is a professional sport.
You're saying the conventions are a lot of fun.
My sport is a professional sport, just no different than kickball is a professional league too, right? People don't treat it serious yet, but in the next 6 months from now, our sport, our industry will be the most...
The NFL.
It will be bigger than the NFL because people just... They know that they're using technology. They know that there's compute that's behind that technology. No one really understands what that is. They just arrive at and stop at, oh, that's the cloud or that's AI, but they don't really ask what those things are. And when people start trying to really scratch the paint and understand what's going on below the waterline, it's an iceberg. All they see is above the waterline. They see AI and they see cloud. What they don't see is 90% of that, which fits below the waterline, which is the engine for technology, and that's what I build. But I don't really build data center technology stacks. I used to think I just built teams that built those things. And I was like, no, I build leaders that build teams that build that. And reality is I build relationships with veterans. And I'll tell you why. I love building emerging technology that changes the lives of everyone around the world. But my real purpose as a business is to stop the suicide rate within the veteran community. The only way to do that is to give them a job of significance in which they are inspired by what they do. They feel safe by what they do and they're fulfilled by what they do. And we spend a lot of time making sure that those three things happen. We're humans, we're not perfect, but we have the right to fail as we try to grow and learn forward too. So I love taking people that are transitioning out of the military and they don't know what they don't know. In many cases, they don't even know this industry exists. They're looking to go back to where they came from. Maybe they got a cousin or an uncle or someone in their family that works at a company that could get them a job. I don't know shit about that. I'm like, there's an industry that loves you, finds tremendous amount of value, and most importantly, they need you. We are 300,000 people short between 9 different job domains that represent 265 different jobs in this vertical of industry. We don't need college degrees. If you went to college for this, by the time that you graduated, everything that you started your freshman year would be automatically obsolete in this world anyway. All I need is someone that has the ability to come in early, stay late, and volunteer to do hard shit, and we'll find a job for you of meaningful value, and we'll pay you proportion to that value. The whole industry is starving for talent. I can't get it coming out of college. I can't get it coming out of the trades, and I can't get it coming out of high school. But I do have thousands of soldiers, sailors, and airmen that are leaving the military every month. And they didn't join the military to make money. They did it to make a difference. And I want to offer them an opportunity of significance to make a difference in an industry that's growing. We're blue sky. In the next 6 months from now, this industry will be, first of all, this is the most punk rock industry you've ever been in. It's the most amazing industry you can imagine because it's so under the radar. We get to iterate faster because we don't have the bureaucracy and the regulators. But the founders of this industry are going to be sunsetting soon, and they're going to be the policymakers of governance, and they're going to get us to have more ethics and all the things that go into taking a building, an industry, and making it more mature and more mainstream. But we have to grow up and do that to solicit the talent that we need. I don't need people going to SpaceX. I need them to come here. I need all that passion and all that talent, although I don't really hire for talent, I want their talent and their passion to come here so we could groom them and develop them to contribute to something greater than themselves. What I found is military people, they're really trained on advanced weapons and machines and technology, and they're used to being conditioned and trained. They believe in hierarchies, and they're the best ones to come in because it's left seat, right seat, cockpit training from the moment you get here, right? And I know that they've been through the same thing that you and I went through. And that's the pressure testing and the stress inoculation that starts at basic training. That's not, I mean, they're not hugging you to death when you get the basic training. They're in your grill. They're trying to, you know, redefine the constitution of you as a human, and they typically do a pretty decent job at it. And if I could take those people and then give them an opportunity to be significant again, then I could help advance this industry. And if I could advance this industry, then what I will do is I'll advance society and humanity by driving more to the tipping point that gets it to the point where data centers merge so much, demand so much power, that it requires a tipping point in economies, which means we no longer rely on fossil fuel and coal. We will rely on nuclear energy. Until we get there, we're going to use natural gas.
I'm a veteran listening to this, thinking, hey, Kirk, this sounds pretty good because I'm a I'm a little lost on where my path is heading. I'm about to get out. I ETS, as we say, in about 1 year. Where can vets find you to look more into this industry and the opportunities you at Overwatch can provide them?
Nah, that's a good question. I appreciate it. So there's a few places, right? We host conferences. The microphone allows us to get on every base and every post that we could get to. LinkedIn is a social media platform that we use as professionals. We're professional athletes just like them. They need to reach out to us on that. And everybody, the beauty about this industry is everyone's approachable. I have Henry Ford in this industry. We have, every industry has celebrities. Your industry has celebrities. You're one of them, right? What I'm saying is every industry has celebrities and we know their names. This industry has celebrities and even those celebrities are approachable. Can you imagine if basketball was to the point where everybody can walk up to a LeBron James and talk to him? My sport has a few LeBrons and those people, I could go to them with my hat in my hand right now and be like, I have a stupid question. I'm like, let's do it, because they want to advance this industry. So I would say find us. We're Overwatch. We are Overwatch.com. We made our domain. We are Overwatch.com. So you know where to find us. And if you find that there's a link there, just click it. Or go on LinkedIn, create a LinkedIn profile, look for Overwatch Mission Critical. We're not doing this to take part of this industry. We're doing this to grab as many soldiers, sailors, and airmen as we can to stop the cycle of suicide so that we could take over this industry. This industry doesn't only need us. It finds so much value in what we've been conditioned and trained on that it doesn't matter if you're a bullet sponge in the infantry or if you're a submariner. It does not matter. What matters is what you can do in this industry, not what you did do in the past. And I think that people come here, they didn't join the military to make money. They wanted to be significant. And I offer significance if they come into this industry and join it with us. Does that make sense?
It does. Well, Kirk, I'll say this. If a good majority of humans had the passion you have for what you do, regardless of their profession, this world would be an immensely better place. And that's, let's be honest, a good portion of people within the United States, possibly the world, I can't speak for the world, lack passion. They lack focus. They lack a concrete goal, that aim for where they're heading. And you're trying to provide that. And that's altruistic. And I commend you for that, man. And
we all started from somewhere.
Hey,
I was them. The people that you were just describing was me until I had a moment, right? And we all have a moment. So you're a moment for a lot of people. Hopefully we get to be a moment for other people. But I'm trying to change society and I'm trying to change humanity. And the industry that I work in is the only one that can do that. No other industry can transform society and humanity more than data centers. Because we all share, rather perverse, it doesn't matter if it's professionally. Try to imagine doing your job professionally without using technology and then try to go home and manage your life without it. As long as there's those things, there's going to be this massive demand for the compute technology. And that compute technology is called a data center. And that data center is the sky for the cloud and it's the home for AI. And without data centers, there's no technology. So we need people to start looking below the waterline a little bit more and trying to understand how to get more involved with that, because they all love the product. They all love technology, and that I've never met anybody that wants less of it, but they just don't know how they can take their skills and their passion and park their careers in an industry that needs them, is starving for them, will pay them proportion of their value and give them every opportunity to grow. We just need to get more of them here. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about it on your podcast.
You know, you said something. I'm proud to say I started as a PFC in the Marine Corps.
I was just
saying. And it was a long pathway, seaman. That is the worst rank in the world, man.
I was never that. But yeah, okay. I mean, like when you're my rate, you come out typically right out of basic, like in whatever, right? So like you go to a school real quick and then boom, you're snapped.
You're promoted.
Yeah. So, but the thing is I hear you, man. We all started from somewhere.
Absolutely.
So listen, thanks for your time. It's an honor to meet you and spend time with you. I've had a chance to spend a lot of time with you. And I think that you and I plan on spending a lot of time together in the days to come.
I think we will. So again, for everyone, veterans or just listeners, go to weareoverwatch.com. I will say, in terms of branding, you guys nailed it. Whoever your graphic designer is, and I know you have input, you guys have nailed it. And especially, can people buy your t-shirts
online? Yeah, if you go to our website, there's Data Center Savage is another website, but you'll link it from ours.
Yes.
And you can see that we wanted to make t-shirts for this industry because you don't, have you ever walked into a mall or in a park or gone to a festival and saw the word data center written anywhere?
You've done it in an interesting way.
We're trying to get the word more prevalent. That word will one day be at the tip of the spear for everyone's lexicon. Give it 2 quarters and everyone will have been it's such a prevalent term in the next 6 months from now that everyone will have been familiar with what that word is. It'll just take a few years before everyone understands what it is. But data centers, we're trying to make data centers cool again, so we're trying to make cool shirts for it. And you can go to our website and you can pick us up. We also host one of the most popular conferences in the industry. It's in Austin. I rent out Austin City Limits for 2 days in downtown Austin every year, and we host. You know, we didn't think the industry really necessarily needed another conference. We just felt that it needed a better one with a better purpose. So we get a little bit more disruptive, and we try to create an opportunity where our environment allows for a greater exchange of ideas. So we bring in some of the most powerful people in the world from the technology industry, from every one of the major companies that we've talked about, and they all get on stage, and they all talk about what's coming down the line. And it's really exciting. So I'm excited to talk to you. You're going to be on that stage with me, and we're going to be talking about leadership.
Let's do it. All right, guys. This education in data centers has been brought to you by Overwatch and Kirk O'Fell by compliments of Men's Journal. And that was an education, man. Again, I think a lot of people listening to this who just, like myself, had no clue, will wake up to the demands of this industry from the American society and the world as a whole.
So, every listener that you have to this podcast touches a data center a dozen times a day. This podcast is an example of how they're touching it.
Damn. Know the world you operate in and how it operates.
Yes,
and
sir.
The mechanisms. All right, guys. This has been a great episode, Kirk. I appreciate it. And from Men's Journal, the Everyday Warrior podcast, till next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.